Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Hello and welcome to a brand new season of the Folklore Podcast. I'm Mark Norman, folklore researcher, author, and creator of the podcast. Before we begin, I'd just like to take a moment to thank you for your continued support of the show. It has developed into something far bigger than I ever imagined it would become, and that is down to your engagement. The feedback you send via Twitter or other social media is always humbling and means that we continue to strive to grow and expand upon what we offer in the way of free access to experts in folklore and folk tradition from around the world. If you are new to the podcast, then welcome and thanks for choosing to listen. The whole back catalogue of episodes is still available to listen to on the Folklore Podcast website, and I hope that you enjoy catching up. Just a quick reminder that the main episodes of the podcast will always be free to listen to and accessible to everyone. But we do need your help and support where you can to keep things that way. After 5 seasons, the show is still ad-free with no annoying sponsorship breaks, and we want to keep it this way. But it does take a lot of time, resource, and investment to maintain this approach. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then do consider signing up to our Patreon page for a small monthly donation. You'll be able to access extra bonus content and resources, and even the $1 a month tier will reward with our folklore audiobook partworks. The address for this is www.patreon.com/thefolklorepodcast. If you don't want to contribute regularly, then you can visit the Folklore Podcast web store and make a one-off donation there. And if you can't contribute financially, then there's other things you can do to help, such as leaving positive reviews or sharing the episodes with comments on social media. This all helps to increase the audience and allows us to bring our content to more people. Thank you for anything you do to help the continued success of the show. We start Season 5 rooted in old folklore by revisiting a popular topic, fairies. My guest today is Morgan Daimler, who is the author of many books on this subject as well as Irish lore and belief. Up for discussion is Morgan's book, A New Dictionary of Fairies, which is a continuation of the pioneering work undertaken by one of the greats of folklore, Catherine Briggs. Morgan concentrates on the Celtic and Western European traditions in particular, and their work is good, solid folklore collecting and research with a passion for the topic. It's an interview which I think sets us up for a great season of shows. I hope you enjoy it. Hi Morgan, welcome to the Folklore Podcast and welcome to the first Folklore Podcast of Season 5. You are here in the number one spot as the first guest of the new year, and it's a pleasure to have you here.
That's very exciting, start of a new season.
It is indeed. So today we are going to talk about one of your many books, and that book is A New Dictionary of Fairies. Fairies being a subject that we have discussed before on the podcast, but relating to slightly different things. We've discussed them relating to modern sightings of fairies, and we will touch upon that, but obviously we're looking at some kind of deeper area of folklore, and we've looked at fairies related to witch trials in the past as well.
That's a fascinating topic.
It absolutely is, and obviously comes up with what you cover, which is predominantly an exploration of Western European and Celtic fairy traditions. Now, before we get into that, let's just start, if we may, by you saying a little bit about how you became interested in folklore and fairy traditions and the other things that you research.
I've pretty much always been interested in fairy traditions specifically for as far back as I can remember. And I started getting more interested in wider folklore and in what we have for written fairy material probably when I was in my teens. So that would have been the 1990s, if I can date myself slightly there. And, you know, religiously I am pagan, so there is a bit of an overlap, I think, sort of between the spirituality and then the more academia side of it. And the more I got into researching it, it sort of becomes almost an obsession, trying to learn as much about it as you can. And there's always more to uncover, more to learn. So it's such a fascinating topic, and it's so broad, but at the same time, in its way, so specific. And so that also kind of fascinates me. You know, there's this overarching motifs with it, things like, you know, the fairy midwife and the stolen bride and changelings, things like that. And yet, when you get into different regional beliefs and specific areas, even within those motifs, you can see these very specific, detailed approaches to how the beliefs are incorporated and integrated into communities and into, you know, living belief systems. So all of that just really intrigues me. And I do not have a degree in folklore specifically. I actually have a degree in psychology, but I think there might be some overlap and interest there as well. So I sort of have used what I learned getting that degree to my approach, to studying fairies and fairy lore, both the historic material and the modern material.
Well, folklore, of course, is all about belief at the end of the day. And,
right.
You know, what is psychology if it's not a subject which looks at why people behave the way they do and why they believe the way they do? So, yeah, there's certainly a great deal of crossover, I think, between psychology as a subject and folklore. And you're absolutely right when you talk about things like the fairy midwife, of course, as well. You find it in lots of different aspects of folklore, don't you, that as stories travel geographically, then they take on these cultural aspects from where different people settle. So you still get that same core story with these extra bits kind of bolted on, which changes it slightly.
Right, and it's to me, it's just deeply fascinating to look at how that sort of wider overarching pattern to it can stay the same, even in very diverse places and across different sort of cultures in some cases, and yet still have its own particular flavor when you're looking at specific areas, the way that different communities adapt it or adopt it. You know, it's just really intriguing.
It certainly is. So let's have a look at some of these aspects then of fairy folklore that you discuss. But before we get into any detail, I'd just like to start, if I may, by reading one of the quotes that people have said about your book from the very first page. And that quote is as follows: "I cannot recommend this book highly enough. Indeed, I would call it a worthy successor to the work of the late, great Catherine Briggs, the most highly regarded expert on fairies in the last half of the 20th century. Would you like to say a little bit about the work of Catherine Briggs and how your work follows on from what she did?
It's hard to say a little bit about Catherine Briggs. You know, she really is sort of the staple, the mainstay when it comes to fairy lore. And a lot of her work, in my opinion at least, was very seminal in the field. She brought together a lot of diverse material into one resource. And she's written quite a bit on the topic of fairies, of course, across sort of the breadth of her career. My book was an attempt, you know, and clearly just an attempt, but to sort of have a more updated, modernized version of Briggs' Dictionary of Fairies. I don't really compare my work with Catherine Briggs' work because hers, the scope is much broader and much more in-depth than what I was able to do. But, of course, you know, she was working more in the middle of the 20th century. Dictionary of Fairies, for example, came out in the 1970s. Her Encyclopedia of Fairies was around the same time. And, you know, the majority of her work was sort of in that period between the, it was the late 50s or early 60s and the late 70s. So, you know, enough time has gone by really at this point that there's a lot of new information, there's a lot of new material, sort of new things that have been written when it comes to fairies and fairy lore, obviously a multitude of new anecdotal accounts. And there really hasn't been, as far as I'm aware, as someone who does try to follow this field fairly closely, there really hasn't been another attempt like what Briggs did. There was a book on English folklore that came out in the 90s. It's not fairy lore specific, but it does have the same sort of tone to Briggs' work. But outside of that, particularly in the last 20 years, there's really nothing out there that tries to bring a lot of this material together the way that Catherine Briggs did and create a resource that is both fairly accurate for what we have on the material and also covering as much of the material as possible. And again, I had my limitations, you know, with what my publisher would allow me to do word count wise and what I could feasibly include. But, you know, the idea was to offer something that would, at least in spirit, be an update of what Briggs had done in the 70s, because her work is so very essential. There are many people who still look to it and rely on it as a resource today, even 40 years later, because it was so thorough and so inclusive in what it covered. So it's definitely something that we need out there on the market. I would love to see someone else do something that really is the equivalent to Briggs' work and has that depth and that length to it, you know. But so far, there's nothing else out there. So that was sort of where I was coming from with what I did. I have an immense amount of respect for Catherine Briggs and her work. I think that she really shifted in her own way, the way that the fairy material was being treated. You sort of, previous to her, have a much more subjective and opinionated approach to it, what we have in the written material. And then she really took that very academia-minded tone with it, you know, presented it as it was in the living cultures and the belief systems, without necessarily really adding too much of her own opinion to what she was presenting. Although she does, of course, have books where she gets into analyzing the particular fairy motifs. One of her books, Fairies in Tradition and Literature, does that really, really well. So she did touch on that aspect of it, but without the sort of bias, I think, that we were finding in the early 20th century, late 19th century sources.
I think you're absolutely right. I think, you know, I mean, her works are seminal works, aren't they? And people do hold a lot of respect for them. But at the same time, your book really does work as a very good companion volume to that, and it does carry on doing the same kind of work in the same vein. Now, explain a little bit about why you chose to discuss Celtic and Western European fairy lore, and then leading on from that, maybe if you can explain a little bit about the differences between the Celtic and Western European fairies and other traditions.
Sure. My main personal focus when it comes to what I study and what my main interest is in would be Irish material, the Irish fairy lore, and sort of branching out from that, the related Celtic language-speaking cultures, so primarily Welsh and Scottish, just because there's more of that that's been recorded and it's a little easier to access. Although in the book, of course, I do touch on Cornish and Manx and a little bit of material from Brittany. All of them tend to have what I would say, and I think also what scholars would say, are related themes, related tone, if you will, in how fairies are described and approached, treated in the folklore material and anecdotal accounts, in the stories that we see, those wider motifs being carried through. So it can be really productive to sort of compare what we have in one particular area, expanding out into those related cultures. So my interest, as I said, started in Ireland and Irish material, and then sort of grew through comparing it to the other Celtic language-speaking cultures, and then from there to the other Western European cultures, which are also related, although somewhat more distantly, depending on which one we're discussing. So English fairy lore, for example, which has obviously been influenced by assorted different Celtic language cultures, but also has Anglo-Saxon, for example, and other cultural influences which brought in different approaches to fairy belief. And then I do touch on as well Norse, which I think we can safely include in Western European for the most part. And the Norse cultures and their approaches to fairy lore tend to look, when we study them, sort of like distant cousins to what we see in the Celtic material. There's clear similarities. Sometimes there's even reflections of these same wider motifs, changelings, for example, fairy brides, for example. But they have a different tone and approach to them, being given to us through the lens of a different culture. So it gets particularly interesting for me looking at the areas where the different cultures strongly overlapped. So like the Orkney Isles, which were originally Celtic and then became Norse, and have just a very fascinating sort of system of fairy belief there, where you can see echoes of what we would find in the neighboring Celtic cultures, but also that strong Norse influence and clear things like the Trolls, which are believed to be heavily influenced by troll beliefs in different Norse countries. So it just creates this really fascinating mix of beliefs. We see the same thing when we look at Iceland and Icelandic fairy beliefs, which are believed to have been influenced to what degree people aren't entirely sure by Irish beliefs, possibly through a couple different sources. And again, you can see that in the way there are certain similarities between the beliefs in one place and the other. The idea that you shouldn't do any construction or road work that might interfere with the location associated with these beings. That's something we find in Ireland. It's something we also find in Iceland. The idea that they're very fond of dairy products. You can kind of see that in both. You know, so certain aspects like that are carried over. So, you know, while I think there is a lot of value in focusing very specifically on one particular culture, I think having that sort of wider cultural cross-comparison view is also very helpful, not only in starting to see the wider picture that formed and those concepts that exist across the cultures, but also to see and understand what is unique to a particular area versus what is widespread. You really can't see that without looking at the diversity that's out there. When we get outside of Western Europe and we start to get into, for example, Southern Europe or Eastern Europe, because you have a different blend of cultural influences, you still find belief in beings that we would in English, you know, label as fairies, but you tend not to find the same degree or the same wider motifs going on. The beliefs start to get more different, if you will, as you go further out. So that was why I sort of focused the way I did on the cultures that I did, because they have this crossover, probably from the interaction of the cultures, of course, with each other across different historic periods.
And Ireland and Iceland, of course, in modern times, arguably have some of the strongest fairy beliefs and traditions still now. Those you think stem from the strength of the roots in the Celtic fairy lore in those two places?
I definitely think that's a significant factor. I think the way that the beliefs themselves were strongly rooted into the cultures, that also has allowed them to survive to the degree that they do. Of course, as we move further forward into the 21st century and modern technology and everything, it definitely does put pressure on the older traditional beliefs, because it is sort of viewed as backwards thinking or superstitious, which is really unfortunate. I would much rather see people preserving these beliefs and continuing to have them than letting them go. You know, there's in Ireland and Iceland both, there's often sort of an overriding denial that these beings are real. Like, they will tell you that they don't exist or that people don't believe in them, but they act in ways that reflect belief. For example, they're not building roads in certain areas, not disturbing certain locations. You know, the respect that was sort of ingrained in the belief system still exists. And of course, there are people in both places that are either trying to revive these beliefs or to, you know, continue with them, carry them forward, so that does help. But, you know, I think part of why we don't see them as much in some other cultures is that it was sort of easier to eradicate them because they weren't as deeply ingrained in the folk belief with the people, and it was easier for people to let them go, whereas, you know, some places were better at preserving them. And that's not a country-specific statement. That's more of a location, regional-specific statement. I think if you go anywhere that has historically had fairy beliefs, you're going to find places where those beliefs are still there and are still very strong. And then you'll find places where they're not as much. And it is tricky, as I mentioned, because not everyone will publicly acknowledge that they still believe in these stories, still believe in these beings. There can be sort of a habit of denying it or, you know, not outright admitting it, but still holding the belief personally. So that makes it a little difficult to gauge in some circumstances.
Now, when we think about the way fairies look or the way fairies appear, what their makeup is in the Celtic traditions, can you explain a little bit about what the general appearance of fairy in those traditions is compared to some of the other fairy traditions, for example?
Sure. And again, every different region, and particularly if we get into the wider cultural views, will have variations. When we look at the Celtic language speaking cultures, we generally see sort of an array of fairy beings. Fairy being used to describe something, but also sort of in a more broad term. You know, if someone says a being is a fairy, it really doesn't tell us much except that being has an otherworldly nature. So when we look at descriptions of them, you know, they can range from animals. There are fairies that are described appearing as dogs, cats, horses, goats, you know, sort of that whole variety of animals that you might regularly encounter, except these are not regular human world animals. We also see what people more generally might consider the sort of traditional modern, if I can combine those two words successfully, description of fairies as being, you know, 1.5 to 3 feet tall, sometimes looking like children, sometimes looking like old men. But in a lot of cases, when we look at descriptions of these beings, and again, this is across pretty much all Western European cultures, there is a good percentage of them that are described as simply looking like human beings, except otherworldly in some way. Something marks them out as not being a human being who would be your neighbor or live around you. There's something different to them, and not something physically that marks them out. This is more of a perception or an energy around them, or something that people encountering them come to believe. When we hear the actual descriptions of them, they, you know, often will be between, say, 4.5 and 6 feet tall, so sort of in that average human adult range. They do not, contrary to the way that people today tend to perceive them from fiction in particular, they do not have pointed ears. They usually are described with the normal rounded ear. The pointed ear thing comes to us from originally from artwork and then later from fiction. I should clarify before I blame fiction for everything. They generally do not have wings, although that is sort of the way they're depicted now, particularly in more modern art. When we look at the older folklore and the older stories, and even the majority of anecdotal accounts, they do not have wings. If they are flying, they are flying through what we might consider like levitation. They're just up in the air flying with no obvious explanation for how they're doing it. Or they might be riding a horse or an enchanted item in order to pass through the air. But we really don't see the descriptions of fairies having wings again until fairly recently. And that's something that started in roughly the 17th century in the theater, and then became something that was seen in artwork and then finally in fiction. It is interesting to note, and I will mention, that in the recent fairy census that was done, the fairy census is something that can be found online. It's just sort of a collection of modern anecdotal accounts that was done in the, I believe it was 2011 to 2014, if I'm remembering correctly. And that did include modern recent anecdotal accounts of people seeing fairies with wings, which is certainly particularly interesting because it's a notable shift from how they have always previously been described in encounters and in the older folklore itself. So, you know, whether people's expectations of how they look or how they will look are shaping what people are experiencing, or whether something actually has shifted or changed in some sense, you know, that would be up to the individual's opinion. But that is something that's worth noting as a change in the way these beings are being perceived and encountered. The majority of the material, however, that we do have does not include wings or tiny fairies. Of course, it is such a broad range of beings. If you look at specific folklore in specific places, you can find examples that would fit nearly any description that we can come across. There are a group of, I believe it's Manx fairies, that are supposed to be the size of ants, so very, very tiny. Winged fairies, I can't think of any offhand in folklore up until the recent period. Recent being within the last, say, 50 to 100 years. When we move past that, or if we look at cultures with, you know, in Western Europe that have these preserved folk beliefs more strongly, we just don't see that as much. And how that's going to be affected by the wider spread of modern depictions is hard to say. Just part of what made that fairy census so interesting. It's the first time we've seen those descriptions in anecdotal accounts, so it will be something worth watching to see if that progresses and becomes more common.
And the fairy census is a really useful resource as well. That's collated by the Fairy Investigation Society and was collected by Simon Young and is easy to find online. Now, do you think, Morgan, that the Victorian flower fairy symbol has a lot to do with the way that these winged fairies are sort of introduced into the folklore?
I do. And there have been several books written specifically looking at fairies during the Victorian era, because that was a very turbulent time for fairy belief in particularly American and English society, I guess we shall say. There was a marked shift during the Victorian period from what we would find, sort of what I had just described, human-sized, human-looking fairies, or animalistic fairies, or, you know, this sort of wide folkloric array. We start to see that during the Victorian period, and then progressively throughout the Victorian period, shifting into this depiction of fairies as small, butterfly-winged, or insect-winged, sort of insect-like in a lot of senses. As you mentioned, very associated with fairies. Cicely Mary Barker did a lot of illustrations of flower fairies that were very popular and are still very popular today. And that certainly does influence how people perceive them and then imagine them to be and sort of carry that forward. The Victorians were also the ones, I believe, who started the shift from fairies as beings who were ambiguous and often either potentially dangerous or outright dangerous into beings who were more not necessarily harmless, but perhaps more impotent in what they could effectively do to human beings. You know, even if we look at, for example, J.M. Barrie's Peter Pan stories with Tinkerbell, because she would be one of the earlier depictions in fiction of a small winged fairy. You know, we see her still having a bit of that older fairy nature, being possessive and jealous and sort of a little bit vicious in her way. Trying to get Wendy killed certainly qualifies as vicious, I think. But she couldn't actually do that herself in that story. She had to try to have other people, human beings or, you know, the Lost Boys, as it were, act as her agents in order to accomplish what she wanted, in that case, Wendy's death. And that is a definite change from what we see in other folklore, specifically in folklore about fairies, where, you know, they were always seen as beings who were capable of causing harm, able to cause harm. And in fact, there's a plethora of protections against fairies as far back as we have, you know, recorded material about fairies, pretty much.
Can you give a couple of examples?
Because of the belief that if you anchored them, or if you were just very unlucky and in the wrong place at the wrong time, you know, they could and would cause you harm. And it was really during that Victorian period that we start to see the bigger shift into this idea of fairies as not being harmful and also not really being capable of causing harm. And that is something that has certainly carried through and perpetuated forward in generations into the way that certain demographics now understand fairies and what they are. It's a marked contrast to other folklore and to older beliefs. I tend to say traditional beliefs, but when I use that term, I'm just trying to have a shorthand way to refer to the fairy lore as it has existed historically and continues to exist in some places. It is, of course, a living and evolving system of belief. So things do continue to adapt and change. But the Victorian era sort of saw this bifurcation of belief where you would have the older view of fairies as potentially dangerous and not beings that you really wanted to be on the bad side of, beings that you might want to protect yourself against, continue to exist in specific places and in specific forms. But then you also saw this sort of new branch of belief coming forward, particularly popular with middle and upper class people that saw them very differently in size, very differently in description, and certainly very differently in agency. So it's interesting to see now how those two belief systems are kind of coming together and disagreeing in some areas and sort of melding in others, because there has been a push recently towards seeing fairies again as potentially more dangerous or at the least not all friendly and helpful, which is a return to that older, more traditional viewpoint. So it's going to be interesting to see as we move forward and as social media and the internet continues to cause this sort of aggregating effect where people can access across the whole spectrum of belief, how things end up settling out. But yes, the Victorian period and fairies, I could probably talk about that for an entire hour on its own, but it's a very interesting time period for fairy belief, because there was so much transition, and it was such a sharp, noticeable shift. It really sort of redefined fairies, for an entire demographic. So,
So certainly, if fairies are seen in these ways of being more dangerous, for example, then those methods of protection that you referred to earlier on in that segment are certainly something that's still going to be very important in fairy lore. Can you just explain a little bit about what some of those common protections would have been that you were referring to there?
Oh, certainly. I mean, there's so many approaches to apotropaic material when it comes to fairies. Probably the main one, the most common one that you will hear referenced in folklore across the board, and this applies in all the Western European cultures that I was looking at least, would be the use of iron. The idea that iron is something that the majority, not all, but the majority of fairies are averse to, and will therefore avoid. Sometimes we see references to cold iron specifically, which is an iron weapon, any iron that has an edge or a point to it. But the idea that iron in itself and by its nature is something that fairies will not want to be around. Iron has a very interesting history when it comes to that protective apotropaic use, because it is also supposed to be good, of course, for protecting a person against malefic witchcraft, against any kind of negative spirits, demons, fairies, sort of anything across that spectrum, ghosts. That was why graveyards were often circled with an iron fence to sort of contain any potential dangerous or negative entities that might be in there. So iron is a main one that we see. There's one Welsh account from a book from the 19th century by Wyrd Sykes. I believe it's called British Goblins, if I remember the title correctly, where he relates a story of a gentleman who is traveling through the mountains, and the Welsh mountain fairies started harassing him. And finally, in desperation, he pulled his knife, and as soon as the iron cleared the sheath, all of the fairies fled and disappeared. They're just immediately averse to its presence, is the way it's usually relayed. This is why it was common to have some sort of iron around a baby's cradle, or a woman who is in labor, in childbed, if possible, there would be some sort of iron kept around her to ward off the fairies and their potential malefic influence going on. We also see accounts of salt being used as a protection, as a ward against fairies. As I'd mentioned a little bit ago, not all fairies are averse to iron. There are specific types that are not bothered by it. So while it is sort of the main fairy warding that's often mentioned, does not work against all of them. So there's an array of options for people out there. Salt is something that's mentioned. It's generally thought, because salt is a purifier and something that preserves food, for example, that was why the fairies didn't want to be around it. Obviously, we don't know for certain, just that it is recommended. There's also one account in the Fairy Faith in Celtic Countries by W.Y. Evans-Wentz from Ireland, of a gentleman who relayed that the fairies would only eat unsalted food, again, sort of implying they were averse to salt, or at least not particularly fond of salt. Much like the iron, that doesn't apply to everything. Obviously, if you have a Rowan or a Selkie or a Finfolk, something that's in the ocean, salt is not going to particularly bother them. And I should mention quickly before I forget about the iron. Iron is something that was also used against the Alfar, the elves in Iceland and in some other Norse countries. So that is something that's seen cross-culturally. We also have Rowan Rowan and Red Thread in particular is another one that we see mentioned fairly commonly. There's a selection of herbs, St. John's wort, broom. Both of those are thought to be things that fairies don't particularly want to be around, that they'll avoid those items. And then, of course, it's fairly common belief across Western Europe because of the influence of Christianity that things like church bells ringing, Christian prayer, the presence of a Bible, the presence of a cross are also things that fairies will avoid. And there's quite a few different folkloric stories and even some anecdotal accounts about fairies, you know, fleeing when church bells were ringing. There's one particular area, for example, that all the fairies were supposed to have left once a church bell was installed in the local church because they couldn't tolerate the sound of it. Red Caps, who are an English type of, I suppose you would say goblin, but fairy more generally, that are not averse to iron. They're actually supposed to wear iron-toed shoes. And use iron weapons, but they are very averse to anything Christian. So reciting prayers out loud, wearing a cross, anything of that nature is really the only thing that will protect against them, because other things don't bother them. So, and this is just touching, obviously, on a small handful of potential apotropaic items. There's also actions that can be taken, although you just be a little cautious with those because they are also as likely to anger the fairies. So things like keeping dirty water inside a home, that in some regions is thought to ward off fairies because they can't tolerate dirty standing water, feet water. Is what it would be called from people washing their feet when they come in the house. I will say, though, there are other specific areas where having that sort of thing in the house will allow fairies to come in, even if you have other protections against them. So that one is a very localized and regionally specific belief. But the idea that fairies don't like dirtiness or human waste is something that we also find cross-culturally. So the idea that you can sort of get them out of an area if you throw dirty water, if you urinate on the ground, that will make them leave. That is something that we see in various cultures, various Celtic cultures, and also in Iceland. There's actually a term in Icelandic for urinating that translates to driving out the elves, because that was how strong the belief was. It sort of become an idiom. The difficulty, I should say, with that, of course, is that if you do that, it will clear the area potentially of these beings, but it's also likely to make them angry. So you have to sort of judge, make your decision on what the wise choice is there. There's some accounts in the death of Bridget Cleary, who was a woman in the late 19th century in Ireland who was killed by her husband and several of her family members because they thought she was a fairy changeling, that she had urine thrown on her. And for anyone who's familiar with that story and that particular aspect of the account, that is likely why that was done, because it was believed that if there were fairies present, they would leave. They would not remain around that particular bodily fluid. So it is supposed to be effective, just does not make them particularly happy.
Now, as I said earlier, is a massive amount of research in your book, and it is something that we could spend a long time going through. So I just wanted to pick out one or two areas of Celtic lore to explore, which differ in some ways perhaps from some of the other fairy traditions. So could you first off explain to people what the terms Seelie and Unseelie Court mean and how they fit into Celtic fairy traditions?
Certainly. Seelie and Unseelie are Scots words. They're words from the Scots dialect or language. There's an open debate about whether Scots is a dialect or a language. So I will let you all decide for yourselves. But Seelie effectively means, it has, of course, a lot of meanings, but effectively in this context means blessed, lucky, fortunate, sort of has connotations of something that is positive or good. Unseelie, in contrast, is a word that means unlucky, unfortunate, sort of miserable in connotation. And both of those terms came to be associated with the fairies across time and in slightly different ways. Despite having said the word fairy now in this podcast multiple times, it is generally considered bad luck to use that particular word. So what you find is the use of euphemisms, the idea that you would want to use a positive term in case the fairies happened to be around. It was believed they could pass invisibly and that they at any time could be around a person and you would not be aware that they were there. And if you were using a term they did not like, they would become offended and then potentially do you some harm. So the practice of using euphemisms is something that we see, and we see this again across Celtic language-speaking cultures. All of them adopted this practice, which is really fascinating. And the idea was that if they heard you speaking of them, you would be using a term that they did not find offensive, and in fact, in some cases, might find complimentary. So we see these ideas of like the good folk, the gentry, people of peace, mother's blessing, all being applied to fairies. And it wasn't because people believed that the fairies were these things. It wasn't that people believed they were peaceful or good or, you know, inherently kind. But it was because if they were overhearing you, you would want them to see you in a good light and believe that you are respectful towards them. So the term Seelie was originally apparently used in this euphemistic sense. And we can find examples of it going back to the 15th and 16th century in the lowland areas of Scotland. Some of these come from the Scottish witch trials as well. And it's clear at that point that they, when they refer to, for example, the Seelie Court, they weren't actually referring to one specific group. It was a reference to sort of all fairies, the whole category of them. Court in that sense, again, being used in the Scots term of a group or a company. And so we see these references to the Seelie Court and to Seelie White, Seelie Wicks, Seelie Beings. White, I should add, is another Scots word. It just means a being, a living thing. And over time, we start to see this shift and addition of the idea of the Unseelie, sort of balancing out the Seelie. If the Seelie Court are the fairies that people would believe are more potentially kindly inclined towards humans, you're sort of invoking that aspect of them in a sense, using that particular euphemism, then the Unseelie Court as a term was used to describe the fairy beings that were sort of innately inimical to humans, that they had no sort of innate benevolence to them when it came to humanity. Like everything else these are not hard and firm categories. These tend to shift, and being that would normally be categorized, if you will, as Sealy could still potentially be dangerous to humans, whereas beings who would normally be considered unsealy could occasionally be helpful to humans. So it's not a hard and fast rule. It's more of a loose description. The way that Mary McNeil put it in The Silver Bough is to explain that this book was published in 1956, was to explain it as the Sealy court would always give, or Sealy fairies would always give, a warning if someone was offending them or overstepping or engaging in problematic behavior when it came to fairies before they would retaliate for whatever that behavior was. The unsealy court, in her opinion, was the reason that the majority of protections against fairies existed, and they were the ones who were the most inclined to simply sort of immediately respond in a violent manner to any offense along those lines, anything that annoyed them or angered them or upset them. And what's particularly interesting, again, looking at this sort of wider array of folklore, is the ideas of the Sealy and Unsealy court, the idea of these two sort of groups of more kindly inclined fairies and then sort of malicious by nature fairies, was originally very regionally specific. It is something that we really only ever saw in this one particular area, the folklore of this one particular area. And then over time, particularly, I believe, through the written word, it started to be something that was seen in other areas as well. And at this point, it's actually become very popular in modern fiction. Urban fantasy really leans into the Sealy and Unsealy as literal royal courts. So it's interesting to note how what was originally a fairly localized regional belief ended up becoming very widespread. There's no indication of the Sealy and Unsealy courts being found in Ireland, for example. The words are not Irish. The words are very clearly Scots. And in Irish, and in Irish language material, you don't find any sort of comparable concept to that. But when I was in Ireland in 2016, I was up at El Maha at the Iron Age fort up there, Navan Fort Center. And one of the people who was doing the storytelling for that day specifically mentioned the Sealy and Unsealy courts while retelling an Irish legend, the Irish legend of Finn MacCool and his wife, Sav. So that was very interesting to me, to see this incorporation of a very Scottish idea and something that's become widespread in modern terms being incorporated and then retold in an Irish legend and sort of being adapted as part of that, which is certainly a marked shift from the historic approach. So the idea of these two courts, even though they started out very specific, are becoming very widespread. The majority of sources that use them are really not, do not seem to be particularly aware of the source or even really of the meaning of the two words. So there is a bit of distortion that's happening with how the groups are viewed and understood as they sort of continue on, particularly in fiction. It's like a game of telephone. The original folklore gets very lost, but the sort of highlight ideas continue, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does indeed. And there's another aspect which I wanted to very quickly touch on, which you mentioned to me before we recorded tonight when we were talking about ideas, which comes up in the Celtic traditions, but not necessarily in some of the other ones. And that's this idea of the paying of a tithe to hell. Can you just say a little bit about how that fits into the Celtic lore?
Sure. And this is another one that we find specifically in the lowland areas of Scotland. There's a lot of very rich fairy lore in those areas. And the idea of a tithe to hell is particularly unique to the area around Stirling, Aberfoyle, kind of in that locality. And we don't find it anywhere else. You don't even see it in the older material in the northern areas of Scotland. You don't see it in England. You don't find it in Ireland. You don't find it anywhere except this one fairly small regional area. And the idea, put simply, is that I suppose before I get to the simply part, I should start to step back a tiny bit. There are various beliefs as to the nature of fairies and what fairies are. And these run a whole spectrum, and that would be an entire different topic to get into. But very quickly, for the purposes of this topic, one particular approach to understanding fairies is the belief that they are a type of fallen angel, that when the angels had their war in heaven, and the ones who rebelled were cast out, there was also a group of angels who, for various reasons, either because they wouldn't choose a side or sort of purely by accident, ended up also being thrown out, but that they were too good to go to hell, too good to become demons and to go with Lucifer, but not good enough to be redeemed and to stay in heaven. And so these sort of ambiguous angels became fairies. And that is a belief that we find across different Celtic language cultures. But the way it's particularly interpreted in this one area in Scotland is that because they were cast out and because they are now fairies, they are sort of tenants of hell. They do not belong to hell. They are not demons in and of themselves. But the devil and hell are effectively their landlord. And so depending on which particular story we're looking at, either every year or every 7 years, the fairy folk have to pay a tithe or a cane. They have to pay rent effectively to hell in order to continue existing and living where they are and as they are. And one way that they do this so that they don't have to sacrifice their own members is by stealing humans and taking these humans and keeping them for an amount of time. And then when the tithe comes around, they give these humans instead of their own number. And we see this mentioned again. There's a reference to it by one of the people who is persecuted for witchcraft in Scotland during the witch trials. It's also mentioned in Thomas of Ercildoune, which is the older prose predecessor of Thomas the Rhymer, the ballad, and in the Ballad of Tam Lin. And in particularly the ballad material, it generally comes up because the human who's in fairy, whether it's Thomas, who's accompanied the Queen of Fairy into Fairyland, or Tam Lin, who has been taken by the Queen of Fairies and has become the sort of de facto guardian of this well. In both cases, they are concerned, or there is concern, that they are going to end up being this sacrifice, being this tithe, and therefore have to get out of fairy and escape the control of fairy before the tithe happens. The tithe is paid on Halloween, Samhain, because that was the time in that particular location in Scotland, one of the times of year when rent would be paid. So it literally was a rent being paid to hell. And we see a lot of really interesting folkloric overtones going on with this. It ties into the changeling stories, the idea that fairies will take humans. It ties into some of the material that we have about humans who are taken sort of in that moment between life and death and are then transformed to become fairies. And of course it ties into, as I said at the very beginning, this one particular view of the nature of fairies. You know, what are they? From this perspective, they're a type of fallen angel. And so this story sort of grows out of that cosmology, that belief system. And the only way, if you are, you know, chosen to be the tithe, the only way not to actually be tithe is to escape, is to no longer be a member of fairy, which is what we see in the Ballad of Tamlin, where Tamlin has taken a mortal lover and she ends up saving him, rescuing him from a fairy procession the night before Halloween, the night before he would have been sacrificed, as it were. In Thomas the Rhymer, it's the Queen of Fairy herself who sends Thomas away because she doesn't want him to be sacrificed, although she believes that he will be if he remains there with her. So it's a really fascinating thing to see, and it's particularly interesting because it is so unique and so location-specific. Although much like the Seelie and Unseelie courts, it has sort of by its nature spread, you know, whether it's through the popularity of the ballads or just printed word making things easier to access, we do see it being much more well-known than it would have been previously in the original area of belief and outside of it. So it's very interesting.
It is. It's fascinating how something that, like you say, is so geographically distinct can feed into so many of the kind of wider tropes and motifs in the lore. It's really interesting to see how that works. I'm very aware that time marches on and there's so much that we could discuss in this area but won't have time to do. But I'd just like to wrap up with one more aspect to bring this up to date. We've looked at a lot of very traditional folklore and traditional beliefs here. You said to me previously that one of the areas of fairy lore that interests you is the kind of way that these older beliefs feed into more modern popular culture and the way people see these things now and the way they're represented within culture now. Would you like to speak just a little bit about that to finish up?
Sure, I will try to speak just a little bit about it because that is a topic that I find particularly interesting. I actually ended up giving a presentation at the University of, Ohio State University, about the evolution of the Seelie and Unseelie courts, from their original sources in the Scottish ballads into, pop culture and modern fiction. It's just really fascinating to me. And I think we kind of touched a little on it previously when we were talking about the Victorians and the Victorian influence on fairies. And I think that bifurcation that happened during that period, and then this sort of dichotomy of belief that has been going on since then, where we have these traditional beliefs, these older beliefs, these culturally specific beliefs, and then we also have this sort of more popular culture, mainstream, if you will, view of fairies has created a really interesting tension in the way people approach fairies. And we see that more and more, particularly in the last 30 and 40 years, as fairies have gotten more popular in fiction, the way that people are sort of drawing on and blending both that more Victorian understanding of them and view of them, and also starting to look at and delve into the more folkloric understanding and view. And, you know, in some cases what we see is fiction that's trying to steer them back or bring them back into at least a new pop culture version of what they used to be. And on the other hand, we see this continuing evolution that's melding the more Victorian understanding of them with some of the folklore and creating this sort of continued sanitization, if you will, of some of the fairy beings that initially were not sort of incorporated into the more popular culture material. And now as they're taken up into it in fiction and in art, in modern artwork, it's through that Victorian sort of postmodern lens that tries to see them very specifically as more helpful, as more gentle, in a lot of cases, and this is specifically Victorian, although Victorian was an influence on it, Victorians and Theosophy and Edwardian era all sort of shaped a view of fairies as nature spirits, and specifically, you know, guardians and protectors of nature, very tied to the natural human world. And, you know, so we see that aspect of it as well being brought forward in fiction and then incorporated into the more traditional folk beliefs. And the reason this interests me in particular, as I had said much earlier, is that I'm very interested in preserving the older beliefs, the older views. And I do worry that they are sort of being overwritten to a degree. But on the same hand, folklore by its nature evolves and changes. And it's sort of inevitable that as we move into the 21st century, as we move into a very modern technological world, that, you know, fairy lore will change. So I think we're sort of in this transitional period right now, much like the Victorians themselves were, where the way we understand fairies and the way we understand fairy belief is very much changing. And you have that traditional cultural view, but you also have that popular culture filter or lens that gets applied to it a great deal of the time. This is something I see very commonly on social media. And it's going to be interesting, I think, to see how this all plays out and how this all melds if one voice ends up sort of speaking over the other, if they find a common ground, what direction it goes in. But there's definitely been a resurgence in interest in the older folklore being reinterpreted through fiction. So it is something that is more on the minds of people, I think, than it has been in a long time. So hopefully that will be a good thing in the long run.
I'm sure it will, and this is something that goes around, of course. It's not just a modern thing. Folklore is continually changing and developing as different cultural aspects are brought in and as the world around us changes, and that's been the case, I guess, for centuries. It is, of course, extremely important to continue to try and collect as much of this data as possible and to record it both from the older traditions and beliefs and the way that these are changing in modern times, so that we can compare and contrast, but most importantly, so that these beliefs don't get lost.
Exactly.
Now, your book goes a great way to continuing that work that was done by Catherine Briggs to do that with fairy folklore. It is a worthy successor in many ways, although, as you say, it is a slightly different work, but it is a great complement to Catherine's work. If people want to find out more about your research and your book and the other things that you do, where do you suggest they should go to look for that information?
I am on Twitter. I am also on Facebook. As I'm sure it was clear from that last comment. I am very interested in social media and the way that fairy folklore plays out on social media. So I try to keep my toes in there. You can find me on any social media just under my name, Morgan Daimler. I try to keep that very straightforward. My Facebook page is probably the best place to keep up with what I'm writing. I do blog in several locations, but there's sort of three main ones. And of course, I have the book. I also have a YouTube channel at the moment where I discuss fairy lore, little snippets, specific topics. And that's all things that can be accessed on my Facebook page. Not that I'm promoting Facebook in particular here, but sort of everything gets aggregated and centralized there for me. So for the moment, that's probably the best place for people to go to.
Excellent. As Morgan says, there are many places that you can find their work. If you go to the guests page on the Folklore Podcast site, as usual, then I will put links on there to the book and to some other things that Morgan does, so you can follow their work that way as well. Morgan, this has been an excellent start to the new season of the podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today about a subject which is eternally fascinating to many people, and it's great to be able to start the new season with some real traditional lore and to build up from there to see where we go throughout the rest of 2020. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
It was a great discussion, and it is definitely a topic that we could probably talk about for hours and hours and have multiple guests talking about, so
we really could. And you must come on again and talk about some of the aspects of your research in the future.
I would love that.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Head on over to the guests page of the Folklore Podcast to find those links to Morgan's online spaces, as well as their biography and photo. I'll be posting a review soon of Morgan's book too, as well as other folklore books received on a new section of the website for this purpose. More news on that when it goes live. If you are an author or publisher and would like to have your book featured either on the podcast or on the website, then please get in touch for more details. I'd also like to try and end episodes of the podcast this year with a selection of traditional folk music and song, either archive recordings or your own work. If you have recordings, you're in a band, or you're a solo performer and would like to have tracks featured, again, please get in touch. Here to play out this episode is Nan Tuck from Chalk Horse Music. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
in